Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, increasing attacks on the legitimacy and independence of the courts in the United States. What are these attacks? Where are they coming from? And what might be the effect of them on justice in America? We go to a discussion at the University of California, Berkeley's Civil Justice Research Initiative and the Berkeley Law Executive Education Program. And this discussion features top legal scholars analyzing the severity of the situation.
My name is Richard Jolly. I'm a professor at Southwestern Law School and a fellow for the Civil Justice Research Initiative. I'm really excited to be moderating this first panel on this important issue. But before, I want to add one more thanks to everybody, particularly the Berkeley Judicial Institute, which was instrumental in organizing today's event and making this important discussion possible. This panel is going to really focus on the emergence and prevalence of attacks on the court. And for this discussion, we have a tremendous group of panelists. Alicia Bannon will be speaking about the prevalence of the attacks. She is the managing director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, where her work focuses on promoting a fair judicial system and an inclusive democracy. She's an experienced constitutional lawyer and an expert on court reform, access to justice in the legal system, electoral redistricting, and fair representation in government. Denise Clancy will be speaking next about the attacks that are not just on our courts, but on our lawyers, how broad these attacks really are. Denise is a partner in the Oakland, California law firm of Kazan, McLean, Satterley, and Greenwood. She's a nationally recognized appellate and trial lawyer with prominent experience in asbestos and talc litigation and other toxic torts. We will then have James Brosnahan, who will be contextualizing this discussion, both within history and how they've affected courts and practitioners. James is a partner at Morrison & Foerster and a lecturer at Berkeley Law School. He has over 50 years of experience and has tried to conclusion over 150 cases. He's widely regarded as a lion of the trial bar and one of the most respected and recognized trial lawyers in the United States. And finally, we have Dean Erwin Chemerinsky. He'll be speaking about the First Amendment considerations raised by these attacks. Erwin is the Dean and Jesse A. Choper Distinguished Professor of Law at Berkeley Law School, as well as the President of the Association of American Law Schools. He is, of course, a prolific scholar, authoring over 200 law review articles, and an active advocate, regularly arguing appellate cases, regarded as a titan in the legal academy. So with that, Alicia, perhaps you could kick us off by bringing home really the prevalence of these attacks.
Thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you to the other panelists and everybody joining us. So in terms of the prevalence, I mean, there's a broad set of things that you might think about as encompassing attacks on the judiciary, everything from, you know, so-called judges' efforts to delegitimize individual judges or the decisions that they make. To, of course, sort of physical violence. And there have been, you know, some horrifying incidents in recent years of, you know, touching on the physical safety of judges. I'm going to be speaking about one dimension, one piece of a much larger conversation that I hope we'll be covering today, which is specifically looking at state courts and about a particular trend that we've been documenting at the Brennan Center for Justice, where we've been seeing basically assaults on judicial independence in state courts, particularly coming from state legislatures, as well as from governors. You know, to start us off, you know, why state courts? You know, most of the time, and I'm speaking at a law school, and a lot of the time and attention when people are learning about the courts, focusing on the courts, is really focused on the federal courts. And frankly, state courts don't get the same stature or attention, you know, either at law schools or among the public at large. But, you know, the fact is 95% of all cases are filed in state court. They're tremendously important. State Supreme Courts are the final word in, typically at least, the final word in interpreting state law, state constitutions. And, you know, I'll say in, you know, the particular moment, as we have a Supreme Court that has been increasingly foreclosing certain kinds of remedies, state courts are only becoming more important. Just this week, the Ohio Supreme Court struck down both the congressional and legislative maps that had been drawn in the state as violating their state constitution. After, you know, a few years prior, the U.S. Supreme Court had foreclosed federal constitutional challenges to partisan gerrymandering. So, you know, we went to the state courts, and the state in Ohio, the state court stepped up and said that it violated the state constitution. So in a host of areas, you know, not just redistricting, voting rights, criminal justice issues, environmental justice, reproductive rights, state courts are increasingly becoming a real focal point. And that has brought attention, not necessarily public attention, but certainly attention from the political branches of government. And as I said, at the Brennan Center, we've been tracking various efforts by legislatures and governors that are targeting the court. And we've seen, as I said, a troubling trend, often in response to unpopular decisions, especially decisions that are in tension with the with the goals of a particular sitting governor or state legislature, sometimes focused on getting more political control over the judiciary or weakening the court's authority. To give a couple of recent examples, you know, in North Carolina, after Democratic governor won in that state, in the window between when he took off, when he won and was about to take office, there was an ultimately unsuccessful push to pack the North Carolina Supreme Court to get more, more seats to shift that court in a conservative direction. The legislature successfully changed the size of the intermediate appellate court, again, to take appointment opportunities away from the governor. They tried, there's an unsuccessful effort to gerrymander judicial districts to cut the length of judges' terms. They successfully moved the state from nonpartisan elections to partisan elections, all very much and largely explicitly to target that court out of a concern that the court had grown too liberal and that the legislature wanted to have more control over it. And just recently, we've seen calls coming from leaders in that state for the impeachment of certain judges, again, for unpopular rulings or the threat of certain unpopular rulings. In Alaska, you had the governor a few years ago vetoed $300,000 from the state's court budget. Explicitly in response to a ruling by the state Supreme Court there that had blocked restrictions on Medicaid funding for abortion. There, ultimately, there was litigation brought by the ACLU of Alaska that struck down that line of veto on judicial independence grounds, but it had been vetoed by the governor. And in Kansas, there was a move, again, a few years ago to take away the court's, to limit the court's budgetary and administrative authority, and pretty much explicitly in response to a series of unpopular judicial decisions, largely around education and requiring the legislature to increase funding for public education in enforcing various state constitutional provisions. There, the Brennan Center actually represented some state judges challenging a law that had weakened the court's administrative authority. In response to our lawsuit, the legislature actually sought to defund the entire judiciary. They created a non-severability provision between the item that we were challenging and the entire budget for the judiciary of Kansas. There, I think arguably they went a bit too far because there was sort of such public outrage in response to that. It was such an overt attack on judicial independence that eventually the legislature pushed back and they reversed themselves and took out that non-severability provision. But that was the environment in Kansas. And so in 2021, this past year, you know, we saw in many ways a continuation of some of the trends that we had seen, but also in some dimensions a troubling escalation. And the piece that I would lift up in particular is a targeting of courts specifically for their role in election cases, and often, you know, explicitly in response to judicial decisions that had come out in the context of the 2020 election. Now, sort of some overall figures, you know, in 2021, more than a third of state legislatures considered bills that would have limited the court's power or otherwise sought to gain more political control over the courts. Of the 153 bills that were introduced, 19 became law across 14 states. Now, specifically looking at bills that were targeting election provisions or the court's role in elections, you know, I mean, first off, again, as background, I probably don't need to tell folks on this webinar that state courts played a really central role in a lot of dimensions in the 2020 election. That included protecting voters during the pandemic, as well as rejecting partisan efforts to manipulate or overturn election results. And this has, in many states, put those courts in the crosshairs. In at least 10 states, legislatures introduced bills that would have either weakened courts' powers in election-related cases specifically, created new tribunals to hear those cases, or targeted individual judges for their decisions in those cases. In other words, efforts of an impeachment or removal of judges in response to election-related decisions. We saw four bills pass in Georgia. A new law makes it more difficult for certain judges to extend polling place hours because of long lines, power outages, and many of the other issues that come up on election day. And in three states, Kansas, Kentucky, and Texas, new laws prohibit judges from altering or suspending state election laws. In addition to these laws that are sort of specifically targeting election cases, there were a number of others that were passed that sort of went more broadly to either court's power or how judges were selected in the states. We saw 19 states overall considered bills along those lines. And we saw eight bills passed in six states that were these more general bills. To give just a couple of examples, in Montana, we saw the elimination of the role of independent judicial nominating commissions. So in other words, in how the system used to work in Montana was that when vacancies emerged and the governor was supposed to make appointments, there was initial vetting by a nominating commission in an effort to create some independence between the application process and the governor. And this law removed the role of the nominating commissions and now gives the governor the power to directly make those appointments. We also saw bills passed in Kentucky and Tennessee, which change which judges or which courts get to hear certain kinds of cases, specifically cases involving litigation against the state. So essentially some forum shopping to make to funnel cases away from certain courts and towards others. I'll just end kind of where I started, saying that these state courts are critically important and they often don't get the attention that is warranted. And we're early in 2022. Many state legislatures have just started their terms, but we're already seeing some of these trends continue. So, for example, in Pennsylvania, we're hearing word from folks on the ground in that state that the legislature may be taking up a constitutional amendment that's already passed once. The process is it needs to pass twice and go on the ballot. That would take the state Supreme Court, which is currently elected statewide, create districts and give the legislature unfettered power to draw those districts. So essentially to allow for gerrymandering of that state Supreme Court. And so these issues are serious, they're ongoing. And I think there's a real urgent need to pay attention. As I said, state courts are, I think, increasingly going to be playing a critical role in a whole host of areas in protecting rights and hearing cases of great public importance. And yet in a lot of dimensions, they lack the same kind of institutional independence that the federal judiciary enjoys. And I think we're long overdue to kind of give those courts more attention and to sort of mobilize the legal community as well as the broader community to ensure that judicial independence norms are respected and enforced in those courts. Thank you.
Alicia, thank you so much for that fantastic review of just really how widespread this issue is and how, when presented together as you've done, how terrifying this might be when we think about the integrity and the independence of our courts around the country, not to mention the motivations that underlie some of these attacks.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We're featuring a discussion of top scholars at the University of California, Berkeley's Civil Justice Research Initiative and the Berkeley Law Executive Education Program.
Denise Clancy is going to speak next on really how these attacks on the legitimacy of our judiciary aren't tied just to judges, but rather the system and the attorneys that operate within them. Thank you, Denise.
Thanks, Richard. I'm going to go ahead and share screen. All right, everyone should be able to see the screen hopefully now. Okay, so I'm talking today about attacks on the judiciary and more specifically and on counsel. And what I'd like to really convey, hopefully through my talk, is that attacks on counsel are attacks on our judiciary and are attacks on the system as a whole. our very fragile system. So I'm normally a person who, when I give a talk, I say, okay, look, I'm going to give you a talk and I'm going to tell you, we can do it. Like, here's my solution. Just follow the rules, file a motion in limine, file trial briefs. Here's how you fix this whole problem. Yet yesterday and in the weeks preceding this talk, as I was pulling materials together, I became increasingly despondent that I actually don't have the answer, that this is a problem that I have tried repeatedly to solve sort of by myself and with other counsel working with me. And we have not yet been successful in solving it. And let me show you what sort of the depressing things that I unearthed in going through this and preparing this presentation and sort of the journey that I've taken on this path. So when I started out, I come from a family of attorneys, and it was very taboo when I started out after law school to attack counsel. In fact, I was taught you don't even call opposing counsel by their name, that they're the company, you know, they're their client. You don't ever impugn them or do ad hominem attacks. And so this new trend has been very surprising for me and actually hard to deal with. It's not hard to find rules that, you know, you don't attack opposing counsel. I'm going to go through these very briefly. I mean, that our adversarial system itself relies on attorneys to treat each other with a high degree of civility and respect. You don't have to look very far. Section 1 of the guidelines of civility and professionalism state that you have to have dignity, decorum, and courtesy, that they're essential to promote justice. And indeed, personal attacks on the character or motives of the adverse party are by definition misconduct. But the problem that I found is that, well, okay, sure, I can recite the law, I can recite all the rules, but I found that just knowing and reciting these rules, where does that get me? It's gotten us really nowhere so far. And here's sort of the history that I want to show you. So starting out in 2018, this is a case, a closing argument that's fairly infamous because the attorney who gave it later talked in the press about how proud she was about this closing argument and how it, you know, won the case for her. And so if you can see the screen, it says, she says that it's plaintiff's attorneys, I'm looking at the upper left-hand side, that get you to believe any kind of case. And she says, because we're here in New Jersey, particularly in central New Jersey, we're a pretty skeptical bunch. And you can move down and says, we've got the boardwalk games where the games are always kind of rigged against you. We've got psychics, the fortune tellers, the flim-flam man, the three-card Monty, the flea market vendors, who try to convince us that the knockoff goods are really real. We've seen telephone scams, credit card scams, insurance frauds. We've seen it all. And the plaintiffs, they ran out of people to sue. The money machine, the plaintiff's lawyers, and their highly paid $30 million expert, they ran out of people to sue. So she's making quite a direct comparison between the attorneys themselves and I guess sham artists in no uncertain terms. They said, and she said, and I want you to pay attention to this phrase because this is a phrase you'll see a lot. They'll say anything for money, 1-800-CALL, we'll sue. This is her closing argument. This is why she said the plaintiffs brought the case. Just call them, we'll make up a story, we'll get money. And she won. They won the case. And remarkably, then told the press after the case that she decided after doing this, after looking at the talc litigation, that the way to win would be to really hammer hard on that this entire litigation was a sham, quote, a sham concocted by plaintiff's attorneys. So let's think about what that means. So when you say something is driven by attorneys or concocted by attorneys, in what you're really saying is they lied. They manufactured evidence. They came up with falsehoods. They somehow got it through summary judgment. They tricked the court. They got past the motion for non-suit at the middle of trial. And they fooled us all, which is an incredible attack on the integrity of the attorneys. And here she says it worked. So I thought, okay, let's file a motion in limine. Tell the court this is happening. This is violative of the rules. Let's try to fix it by educating the courts. So in 2019, this was a talc case in which I tried with Mr. Satterley, my co-counsel, and what happened in this closing argument after we'd filed a motion in limine, asking them not to attack opposing counsel, they said, they literally said, what a tangled web we have right here. We have Mr. Satterley and Ms. Clancy. And they put the plaintiff's lawyers in the middle of, quote, plaintiff's tangled web, where they claimed that we, Mr. Satterley and myself, had manufactured all of the evidence. And everyone knows the quote, what a tangled web we weave when we practice to deceive. So that was directly referencing and stating that we, the plaintiff's lawyers, were at the center of a web of deception. In 2020, I then handled an appeal where they accused the trial court of letting in all of this deceitful evidence, and said in the very introduction of the appeal that the plaintiffs have been trolling for those suffering from mesothelioma. If you have the disease and if you have ever used cosmetic talc, please call our 1-800 number, they say. This is, and I can promise you, there was no evidence at trial that we had, we even advertised, because we don't, or that we said call the 1-800 number, but that was how, what they put at the forefront of the appeal. Again, this keeps going in 2020. Here's another closing argument in New Jersey, where they say that the plaintiff's attorneys, they found their money train. Because they can get juries to believe there's asbestos in baby powder, the money train goes on for a long time. Why all of a sudden, after 125 years, your baby powder has been on the market, why all of a sudden, why are they bringing lawsuits? It's because of the money train. That's why they're creating, quote, the lawsuit story. So obviously my motions in limine haven't worked. Obviously educating the court hasn't worked. The court in this case in 2020 in New Jersey says at the end of this closing argument, you have now violated a court order against attacking opposing counsel. You have violated so frequently in your closing argument that I can't sift the wheat from the chaff. It's impossible for me to say, okay, this line that you said is permissible, this line that you said is impermissible. And so the court in that case ended up striking the closing argument. And then that led to an appeal. The appellant, J&J, doesn't contest that there had been a violation of a court order, that their attorney blatantly violated the court order in closing. But nonetheless, they argue that the court should have adhered to a lesser remedy than striking the closing. They say that, that it was a violation of their constitutional right for their closing to have been struck, despite the fact that they violated a court order not to attack opposing counsel. But here's the problem. When you are a plaintiff or a prosecutor in a criminal case, and the other side violates a court order, such as attacking the integrity of the profession, when you're a plaintiff and you have a dying plaintiff, the last thing that you could have is a mistrial based on misconduct, right? That is going to irreparably harm your plaintiff. So, or this could be solved on appeal after you lose, but that's an equally untenable situation. Or the court could have issued a judgment and struck all the pleadings of the defendant, but that would be seen as even more draconian. So there was no lesser remedy than striking the closing. Yet, nonetheless, on appeal, we're now battling the issue of another significant error was the striking, this is what defendant claims, of J&J's entire closing argument in the liability phase, allegedly due to improper commentary. We have found no New Jersey decision in which a court has taken such extreme action. So the trial court, we had an issue where we brought a motion in limine. We asked for there to be no attacks on counsel. There were attacks on counsel. The trial court weighed all the options. The trial court struck the closing after there had been repeat attacks on counsel. And yet this is now a major issue on appeal because of the struggle that the trial courts have to grasp for the appropriate remedy when there are attacks on opposing counsel. And so you think, okay, maybe that was the end of it. But no, in 2021, this is Johnson & Johnson's petition for bankruptcy. This is their informational brief, the brief that they filed with the bankruptcy court in letting the bankruptcy court know purportedly what is going on here. And what do they say it's going on? They say, it's against the backdrop of the declining asbestos industry that J&J and JJCI have emerged as new prime litigation targets. Suddenly, a new white powder, not unlike asbestos itself for storytelling purposes, and hope for yet another wave of the never-ending tort materialized. So again, even in the bankruptcy filing, even in a situation where J&J is coming to the court and seeking equity, they say the entire fault lies with the nefarious plaintiff's attorneys who have tried to create a new wave of asbestos tort litigation based on a fraudulent story. So after going through this example and how I've been apparently completely ineffective since 2018 at stopping any attacks on opposing counsel, despite knowing that this is a problem and despite trying everything to stop them, you know, I was thinking, well, what sort of would describe my feelings about this? And the one that came to me was Macbeth's statement when he says, you know, this is just, life is just, have we come to the point where life is just a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing? And I think that's resonant for two reasons. One, it shows how depressed I am about the state of affairs. But two, if the reason that Macbeth says this and it gives Macbeth power is that if higher story that we're living in is meaningless, then all of Macbeth's nefarious actions, they're not harmful. They can be justified because there is no overall construct which would damn them as good or bad. And I think that's resonant here because if we so disrupt our court system and our system of justice that it becomes just infinite ad hominem attacks, then you dismantle the very system itself. Why does this matter? One, it matters for two reasons. If defendants such as this Taut defendant keep doing this, that must show that they have real feedback from real people that it works, that attacking opposing counsel personally is a very effective thing. And two, it shows that they have no impunity. That I showed you a series of things that just keeps escalating from on and on and on, despite all of our efforts to educate and the court as we're in it. And they have not obviously felt that they've suffered any repercussions. That shows that the system in terms of punishing ad hominem attacks is fairly broken. The other reason it really matters is that belittling is powerful. I don't mean to make this, you know, overly aggrandize this, but when you attack people personally, you attack the very fragile agreement that we've had that we're all going to come together civilly to solve these problems based on the facts. This is a very fragile compromise, a very fragile social construct. And by belittling people and making it about the person and not about the facts, you destroy the social construct itself. And if you think about the way that wartime atrocities occur is by dehumanizing the other. The way that we are no longer practicing in a civil system is by dehumanizing opposing counsel. And it must stop. But then I think, you know, what is the story that we all learn that, you know, Horton hears a who? In that story, we learn that the littlest voice matters. It was only till the smallest who in Whoville stood up and spoke out that everybody could hear and know that they had to be respected. And that's resonant to me for two reasons. One, it teaches us that no opposing counsel is little. No one should be attacked in the courts. But two, I want to tell you what is giving me hope now, what is giving me hope is all of the people on this seminar and all these brilliant minds that I'm together with today, who I know can figure out a way to publicize this, to restore integrity to our court system, and to think of ways to empower our judiciary, that this, we go back to a time when this is no longer okay. It's not considered acceptable advocacy to attack your opponent personally. And so it is to you that I say thank you so much for joining, and thank you so much for helping to put our minds together to create a solution.
Denise, thank you so much for providing that fantastic overview and really tying it to your specific experiences and showing how the lack of civility is affecting our judiciary overall.
When we come back, the ethics and issues of a diminished court due to attacks on the legitimacy and independence. Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What happens to justice when the court's independence and legitimacy comes under attack? We're featuring a discussion of top scholars at the University of California, Berkeley's Civil Justice Research Initiative and the Berkeley Law Executive Education Program.
James, perhaps you could speak next on contextualizing this for us, helping us understand both historically and in this moment what this lack of civility and attacks on our courts is looking like.
Well, I'm happy to try to do that. I'm excited about the presence of over 300 people who came to listen to us talk. And the takeaway from both these panels is very simple. This is Friday afternoon. I hope you're going to relax. Monday morning, you're going to call somebody. You're going to write a letter. This is intolerable. Why is it intolerable? The separation of powers took, depending on when John Locke was born in the 1600s, took about 200 years to create. The first people who suggested it in writing, some of them didn't publish it until they were dead because kings sat. And when this country was formed, there were three departments. And of course, it goes without saying, we're talking about the judiciary. And the rule of law is all about the judiciary. And when they are threatened, as they are now, and when the lawyers are threatened, as they are now, that rule of law is undermined. And we have enjoyed a period of time, I think, in our lifetimes, when we haven't had to face that kind of thing. For example, an FBI reports that in 2015, there were 926 threats and other inappropriate conduct against federal judges. By 2019, there were 4,449 complaints. Who's going to protect those judges? That's what this program is all about. Who's going to protect them against the domestic extremists that the FBI also described? Racial and ethnic beliefs, often advocating for the superiority of the whites. Those are real people. They carry guns. They're organized. That's what we're talking about here. It is, we don't want to face, I don't want to face it. I don't want to face it. I've enjoyed going into courts for a long time. I don't want to face it. And then there are all the people who are mentally ill, who come to the courts, in part because they have to be helped in some way, in part because they have some case and they have difficulty in understanding the difference between peaceful presentations. I wrote two articles in 2020 on the defense of the judges. And as often happens when I write an article, nothing happened. I focused on two situations. One was the then president of the United States, who happily started every week attacking some judge somewhere, making ethnic references and attacking a juror who was giving testimony at that moment in federal court. He doesn't know about the separation. This isn't political. This is judicial. And he kept that drumbeat up for quite a while. I also described a little bit something I'm going to talk to you about, and that is what happened in Northern Ireland. It may seem irrelevant, may seem extremely different. But I went six times to Northern Ireland, mostly during the Troubles, which lasted for 25 years. I investigated three separate murders. During that time of the Troubles, 12 judges were murdered. The hate. Nobody in this country knows what the limits of the present hate will be. We don't know that. It is perhaps small, perhaps not so small. The FBI is working hard to monitor encrypted messages that you and I wouldn't see, but are very specific. Next point. What does terror sound like? What are we talking about? The doorbell rings. The judge's son says, I'll get it. Looks out the window, sees a delivery man. Says, it's a delivery man, probably, he said. Opens the door and is shot and dies. That's what happened to a federal judge in New Jersey. Her husband was survived, as far as I know, I hope, but was terribly injured. Why is that? Because she's Hispanic. You think that we are encapsulated in our happy lives, hopefully you're having a happy life, I hope you are, away from all that. Northern Ireland taught me that it can all get out of control. The New York Times today has two articles about civil war in different contexts. After I wrote the two articles and not connected in any way with the two articles, my wife and I, she was a judge for 40 years in the Superior Court in Alameda County, California. We received five emails over a period of about 3 weeks that threatened us with death. Me, because he said, I have no memory of this man because I turned him down as a client. I tell you that story to show you that I'm a person of good judgment. This is what upset him. As to my wife, he sat in her courtroom at some time. We don't know what the problem was. This is a man, and I want to tell you what happens in these cases, who was committed to NAPA, which in California is for the criminally insane. And he was released. We have laws, which I'm very sympathetic about. I like the laws, actually, that try to allow people out when they can be out. But that's a human judgment. Let me tell you that we didn't get a lot of attention on our little problem. I made some calls. I have a voice that I can summon up as a senior partner, which makes it sound like you better do this. And they pretty much ignored that. So what are the precautions? And here we get to this tough question. Do we think that a judge who is threatened with death, as my wife was, or any judges, that gets these letters and these threats, do we think that has no effect on them? Do we understand what happens when someone is threatened like that? Listen to what the man said. Jim, he's talking to me, eat S and die. Okay? I'm going to pump you full of 12,000 rounds of alpha, cyber, whatever. Call the pigs. Go ahead. Prepare for hell, you. And he calls my wife a name. They attempted to kill me with extra lethal injections. Suddenly, we have this man in our life, and I start my mornings looking at the messages to see if there's another one. Now, the process is inadequate. The second department of the government, that would be the legislature, has always been suspicious of judges. They seem to be overruling them and striking down things as unconstitutional and all that. They're a problem. And so their priorities don't meet the same as all the new security devices for the Capitol, which I certainly agree with, and for the Secret Service that protects the President of the United States. These judges, once they leave the courtroom, certainly, they're on their own. And the hate is mounting. It hasn't, like the virus, you can't say that in New York it's reached the peak. Nobody thinks it's reached the peak. And so in some ways, we're getting ready for that. One last point. What happens to a person when they're threatened with death? This was explained to me by a security person. It goes back to the days when people were walking in the jungle All by themselves, they thought, and they hear a twig break. The body fills with sugar to enable you to fight the whatever it is that's coming after you. And the tension rises. Judges are not immune from that problem. So that's my thought on context, Richard. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing that and your personal story.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We're featuring a discussion of top scholars at the University of California, Berkeley's Civil Justice Research Initiative and the Berkeley Law Executive Education Program.
Our conversation then has been pointing out that we have legislative attacks on the courts that are spreading throughout the country. We have attacks on the civility of counsel and the legitimacy of our ability to conduct proceedings that maintain that civility central to it, and that sometimes this civility bleeds over into actual violence, both in our own country and as we've seen in others. Erwin, perhaps you could help us by understanding the very real First Amendment implications that we have going on in this area.
Of course, it's truly an honor to be part of this great panel and this conference. I just wrote an op-ed piece about yesterday's Supreme Court decision. It says, the Supreme Court's decision striking down a requirement for vaccination or testing in the workplace makes no sense as a matter of law or public health. The six Republican justices abandoned their commitment to textualism and ignored the plain language of the statute. They ignored the reality of a pandemic that has killed over 850,000 in the United States, over 10 million in the world. Many more will needlessly go sick and die because of the Supreme Court's ruling. The only way to understand the court's decision is to see as six conservative justices reflecting the misguided conservative denial about COVID and vaccines. Is that an improper attack on the judiciary? It's exactly what the three dissenting justices said yesterday. If I undermine judicial independence in some way, I believe that criticism of courts and of judges is speech protected by the First Amendment. It's a desirable, indeed a necessary part of the democratic process. Would I prefer that all discussion about courts and lawyers be civil? Yes. Would I prefer that it always be accurate? Yes. But I think it's very important to draw a distinction between speech that's protected by the First Amendment and actions or speech that's not protected by the First Amendment. I've learned a great deal from the three prior presentations, but I do think it's important to draw this distinction. So I want to make two points. The first is that criticism of courts, decisions, justices, and judges is protected by the First Amendment, and we shouldn't treat it as, quote, an attack on the judiciary. But second, actions taken against courts and judges, such as recalls, cuts in funding, threats against judges and their family, violence, that's not protected by the Constitution. And that really is a threat to judicial independence. So as to my first point, in New York Times versus Sullivan, the Supreme Court protects, quote, a profound national commitment to the principle the debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and that may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials. This includes what can be said about judges and justices. In 1959, the Supreme Court handed down In re Sawyer. It's a case that involved a very famous labor lawyer, Harriet Boussalag Sawyer, who was being disciplined and disbarred for her criticism of judges. And the Supreme Court ruled in her favor. Here in the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, the most important case was Yagman versus Standing Committee on Discipline. Stephen Yagman is a controversial civil rights lawyer in Los Angeles. He gave an interview with a reporter for the legal newspaper, The Daily Journal, and she spoke of a particular judge and said, his rulings, especially sanctions, were anti-Semitic, that the judge was often drunk on the bench in the afternoons. It's a shame there weren't cameras in the courtroom so you could see the judge was a buffoon. The Standing Committee on Discipline in the Central District of California suspended Yagman for 2 years from practice. Practicing in federal courts. The Ninth Circuit reversed that. And the Ninth Circuit said, speech about judges is protected by the First Amendment. unless it meets the New York Times standard of actual malice. That is, unless it can be proven that the speech was false with reckless disregard of the truth. Subsequent to the Yagman case, the American Bar Association amended Model Rule 8.2 to specifically say that lawyers could be punished for their criticism of judges of courts only if it met this standard, only if it was shown there was actual malice, that the speaker knew the statement was false or acted with reckless disregard of the truth. This is the way that it should be. Judges are government officials. They should be no more immune from criticism than any other government officials. Indeed, the decisions of the Supreme Court, of lower courts, federal and state, affect all of us, often in the most important, the most intimate aspects of our lives. I would be a hypocrite to say anything else. If you look at the titles of some of my books, like The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, The Case Against the Supreme Court, or most recently, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Has Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights, you see that I try to practice what I'm talking about today. I didn't like when Donald Trump referred to a judge in Washington State as a so-called judge. I didn't like when he attacked a judge in Southern California on account of race, but it was speech that was protected by the First Amendment. I have heard some say that such criticism of courts and judges undermines legitimacy of the judiciary. But in a democracy, we never try to gain legitimacy for an institution by silencing critics. I cannot try as a dean of a law school to enhance my own legitimacy by silencing those who would want to criticize me, nor can we do that for judges or for courts. Besides, legitimacy that's gained by silence is a false legitimacy. It also assumes that this false legitimacy is more important than speech. Denise made important points about the lack of civility within the legal profession. Been a lawyer for over four decades. I've seen in the briefs that are filed against me and in the briefs that I read the lack of civility that she describes. I believe that is highly undesirable and I strongly support efforts at civility. But I also think when we're talking about judges and courts, we're talking about government institutions and they need to be subjected to criticism like any other government institution. But second, there is a threat to judicial independence. When the attacks on judges and courts go beyond the verbal that's protected by the First Amendment. And here I think what Alicia was talking about was so important. And these are the attacks on the judiciary we should focus on. This is where what I think that Jim Brosnahan was talking about, so important and something that we need to focus on. Let me give some examples. Let me start with something that occurred in California just a couple of years ago, the recall of Aaron Persky. Judge Persky was hearing a sexual assault case. He issued a sentence that was within the recommendation of the probation department, but he was then targeted for a recall. So much that was said in the recall effort about him and his rulings was just false. He was attributed to handing down cases where he wasn't the judge at all. We saw that claims about the importance of judicial independence have little resonance with the voters. 60% of the voters decided to vote in favor of a recall of Judge Persky. By all accounts, Judge Persky was an excellent jurist. I fear that this attack on the judiciary will resonate with judges throughout the state. They know that if they hand down a sentence that's perceived as too lenient, they could be subjected to recall or defeat. But I've never heard of a judge being subjected to recall if the judge hands down a sentence that's too draconian. The threats to the budgets of state judiciaries is a threat to judicial independence. This is what Alicia was talking about. There are examples in addition to the one she mentioned. There's how when the Kansas Supreme Court required the funding of schools in the state, the Kansas legislature threatened to defund the Kansas judiciary. Or a successful instance when this occurred, when the Alaska Supreme Court said that the Alaska Constitution required state funding through Medicaid of abortion, the governor of Alaska cut the Alaska judiciary's budget by exactly that amount. That is a threat to judicial independence. What Jim spoke about is something we have to all listen to carefully. When judges, the family's physical safety is threatened, that's not speech protected by the First Amendment. The Supreme Court has long said that true threats are not constitutionally protected speech. We need to respond and respond clearly and forcefully to protect our judges. And then there are the acts of violence that have occurred against judges. I think here of Robert Vance, a judge on the United States Court of Appeals 11th Circuit, who was killed by a bomb. I think of Joan Lefkoe, whose husband and mother were killed when a disgruntled litigant came to where she was living. And there's been mention already of Esther Salas. It's the story that Jim was telling, a federal judge in New Jersey, whose son was killed and whose husband was shot. We must do more to protect our judges from these threats. There has been a 400% increase in threats against judges in recent years. There's things we need to do. We need to dramatically increase the budget at the federal and state level, provide detection for judicial officers. Also, we must make sure that we can cleanse websites and social media of any identifying information, such as home addresses for judges, so as to do more to protect them. So what I've tried to say in my remarks is I think it's crucial to draw a distinction between attacks that are protected speech under the First Amendment. And they may make us uncomfortable, but that's what the First Amendment is about. And other types of attacks, and that's really where we should be focusing our attention.
Erwin, thank you so much for those fantastic comments. We have a few questions coming in from the audience, and all of them are really focusing in on this distinction between the legitimate type of attacks and conversation, Erwin, that you're discussing, and the way that it bleeds over perhaps into this hyper-partisanship, the way that it might be used for gamesmanship and ultimately towards violence. I'm wondering if you and any of you have this sort of way of articulating or thinking about where that line is drawn. Some of even the legislative approaches, Alicia, that you've spoken about, they've been directly designed at disempowering courts who have made decisions we don't like. Others have tried to correct or expand or democratize in some sense some of our courts. Where do we draw this very speech and violence, perhaps that's an easier line, response and almost punishment is a different line. How might we think about this?
Well, I agree with not only the words the dean just shared with us, but the sentiments of if we're a democracy, then there will be wild debate. There won't be, however, falsehood. I noticed, for example, in the our firm represents some of these folks, so you can discount my reactions. But Congress doesn't seem to understand that a lot of what's on social media is protected by the First Amendment. And they're going to regulate it or something. They're going to do something. And I think the line is not just a legal line, but it's a governmental line. It kind of depends on who's talking. It is true that the president can say and did say all kinds of things, and that's his right under the First Amendment. I agree with that completely, and I have the right to vote. And I would like someone with the discretion to not attack people because they're of Spanish heritage and so forth. I would prefer someone who figures out a way to bring us all together. I just want to underline the fact, I think we're headed into a terrible time. And I don't think the judges are immune from the violence, which is not protected by anything.
I'll jump in just to say, I think certainly the speech that Dean Chemerinsky was speaking to is protected speech under the First Amendment. And, you know, I too criticize the Supreme Court all the time. And, you know, I think that's not only appropriate, but healthy and a critical part of a healthy democracy. I do think that there are kinds of speech criticizing judges that while protected under the First Amendment, it's appropriate to condemn and to try to, you know, to the extent that we have, you know, social norming to discourage that and for there to be, you know, kind of social consequences to sort of antisocial behavior. I mean, I'll say we do a lot of work at the Brennan Center in the States and, you know, just speaking with people that we work with on the ground anecdotally, some of these kind of very targeted personal attacks on judges' integrity in the context of criticizing opinions, whether they be right or wrong, or criticizing the court may be right or wrong, anecdotally, at least, you know, very much, I think, has sometimes contributed to concerns about things like physical safety and, you know, more broadly have contributed to concerns about sort of what that might mean for kind of public confidence in the institution, things that we value. And so, I mean, I think all I would say is that I think that there's the question of what do you try to bar or use the power of the state to limit? But then there's also the question of, you know, what should we as the legal community or other interesting actors, you know, condemn? And I think it can be important at times to speak out when people cross the line and recognizing that where exactly that line is between appropriate criticism and inappropriate speech is a hard one. And, you know, obviously itself subject to debate.
Are there appropriate reforms that don't constitute attacks? Some of the measures you were outlining at the beginning of our conversation seemed vindictive almost towards actors who had made decisions. Dean Chorinsky mentioned some of these as well. Are there some reforms that would not constitute attacks, but that might fall more within the type of fair criticism and speech that we have been talking about that can be healthy for our democracy?
Absolutely. I think here too, the lines are not always clear. I think the context matter. Something could be retaliatory in one context and, you know, be a perfectly appropriate, you know, court administration reform in another context. I think there is also, you know, an appropriate back and forth between the courts and the political branches, you know, around judicial decision-making. I mean, that I think might be a webinar in itself, but yes. You know, I think with all of these things, the lines can be difficult to draw, but I think it's also important to call out when we see very kind of overt and extreme attacks on judicial independence.
I cannot thank you all enough for this fantastic panel. I would love to have this continue going on. Today's afternoon will continue going on. So Alicia, Denise, James Irwin, thank you so much.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.